Hi, my name's Tori and I wish I knew more about blood products.
Hi, my name's Letitia. I wish I knew more about taking care of myself when starting shift work.
Hi, my name is Lydia. I wish I would know more about how to work as in a team and solve conflict.
Hello, welcome to Five Things, the nursing podcast from the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital. My name is Liz Crowe.
I'm Jesse Spur, and this is a podcast by, for, and with the amazing nurses and health professionals in our corner of the world. We hope to connect with a global community as we move from surviving to thriving. Welcome to Five Things.
Hello, my name is Liz Crowe.
And I'm Jesse Spur.
Welcome to another episode of Five Things. And today is very special in that this is part two on our deep dive into eating disorders. So on episode 58, we were lucky to have Erin, a psychologist, come and explain to us all about eating disorders. But today we are welcoming Bronte Moroney, who's a clinical nurse who used to work with the Queensland Eating Disorders and is now currently a CN with the Consultation and Liaison Psychiatry Team down at Logan Hospital. But today, Bronte, you're going to come and speak to us about five things we need to understand about supporting the person with an eating disorder as a patient. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We would love to know how you got into doing this specialised work.
Yeah. So I studied at Griffith University for my nursing degree. And my grad year, I went into mental health. It was the area that I found most interesting. I felt I was most engaged and I wanted to know more, especially why people do the things the way they do, how they behave. I found really, really interesting. So my first sort of permanent role was on H floor, so the eating disorder specialty area. It's the only inpatient ward in Queensland that we have five beds, so it's quite specialised. So I was trained there, and so the majority of my career was on H floor. So after that, I did a bit of student facilitation, so a bit of student education. I found myself kind of, when I would educate, I would find myself most passionate about talking about nursing, about eating disorders. Worked at Queds for a while, which was great. So seeing the community side and how treatment works there outside of hospital. And now I've abandoned the Royal, unfortunately, and I've gone to Logan for a bit of a different experience. So doing a consultation liaison service, which has been so interesting, providing recommendations and support to the team for eating disorders in the medical ward. So seeing what treatment is like from the treating team's perspective and the goals and the planning and that sort of thing. So kind of been in all areas of how we manage and how we support and how we support nurses and the treating team as well, especially in an area that can provide a lot of anxiety and unknown to staff.
Yeah. So I guess today you're going to share this lovely wealth of knowledge from all those areas to work out how we can best support people who have an eating disorder when they're an inpatient.
Yeah.
We were talking just off recording before. You mentioned that you had a COVID holiday back in medical nursing as well. So
yeah.
I think it's really important to ground that back in because you said a lot of your career has been mental health specialty and eating disorder specialty, but you're wearing a double hat, so can't talk with great credibility on them.
So I went back and did a bit of, I was originally doing some mental health nursing in the COVID wards, so especially when we had to remove COVID positive patients from the mental health wards and nurse them in the medical area, which is sort of a challenge in within itself. And then decided to, apply for a contract to, start building up my medical nursing skills again and go back into that area. So it was a really nice change. It gave me a bit of more of understanding, especially when we would have patients with eating disorders come over from the medical wards to mental health. And so I can understand a little bit more of their experience and see why, certain things were happening or they felt the way they felt, because medical wards are so busy. Like it can be a really tough environment. Coming at it from both sides, I think gave me a really a good appreciation, understanding of how, what medical nurses are under and what they have to deal with on a daily basis. Not that I have a lot of experience, but I did have a bit of time there.
Yeah. So you're going to marry that experience for us today, and we're going to work through how we can best support a person with an eating disorder when they're an inpatient, maybe for something else.
Yeah.
All right. So your number one is understanding eating disorders and the distress for someone who has an eating disorder when meal times come.
Yes. So I think especially when I was starting out nursing eating disorders as well, is that I felt as though I felt more capable when I actually understood what an eating disorder was. So understanding the core psychopathology of it. So I've just go into a little bit of just definition there. So it's the over evaluation of shape, weight, and self-worth, and the over investment in controlling that shape and weight. So it's a severe disturbance in their eating. And it's the persistent restriction energy intake that's leading to that significant lower body weight. And they have that intense fear around weight gain. And there's a large element of control there. Of course, I'm just speaking from a place where, from a treatment, not experience perspective. So every eating disorder is very individualized. So it's going to be different for different people. They may come at it from due to a trauma experience, and this is their coping mechanism gaining some control back. But an eating disorder is in essence, that's sort of what the basis is. So I think coming at it from a, if you're not having a good understanding of it, you can sort of come at it from a frustration point of view. So especially because we eat, you know, intuitively, people who don't have an eating disorder, it's not an issue. It's not something that they overly think about. So when someone's coming into hospital, you think, oh, the solution is just to eat. That would solve all their problems. But part of this illness is that it's not logical. It's the fear of losing that illusion of control that's there. So it can be so distressing. So asking someone to just have breakfast or to have a snack or is like kind of asking them to sort of drink poison in a way. So it's going against every thought, every motivation they've had for 95% of their thoughts throughout the day. And it controls every aspect of their life. So everything that they are believing is what they need in that moment. And it's having that disconnect of what the body needs and what the eating disorder is telling them to do. So when you're understanding the distress, I think it's very important to sit down, actually have a conversation with the patient. So the teams are going to be coming in talking about, you know, the nutrition that they need to restore that that medical stability. CL psychiatry are coming in trying to talk about what was leading up to this admission, trying to develop some sort of an idea around it. But when it comes to that nursing care, you are going to be the most frequent person that's going to be seeing them every day. Especially in this journey of hospital, which is anxiety provoking for someone who doesn't have an eating disorder in the first place. And understanding that this isn't just, you know, a choice not to eat, it's the illness there. So sitting down and having that conversation of what is the most distressing part for you? Is it breakfast that you're going to be finding the most challenging? Is it dinner that's the most challenging at the moment? And going over, it may be everything. And being in mental health as well, we'd want to sort of prepare ourselves as best as possible so we can support them. So whether that's utilizing PRN, which I think is quite underutilized, and I think I can sort of draw from experience that it's quite nerve-wracking for medical nurses to plan ahead when it comes to PRN. Usually you'd provide PRN when they are at the heightened state and they're distressed and you think this is the time. Whereas if we're preparing for this, for the distress, which is inevitably going to come because I've told you, like, I don't think I can do this. So you're preemptively preparing to stop that fight or flight response in that moment. So planning, maybe if dinner's the hardest part, maybe give, you know, a low dose of the PRN benzodiazepine at 4:15 and give it half an hour to kick in, and then come up, you know, approach it as though I'm trying to help you be able to deal with this situation as best as you can. And this is how I'm going to be trying to help you in this moment, is providing that.
So you're giving us a lot of wonderful content there, and I'm just going to try and embed it in a way we can all remember. So let's imagine that I have an eating disorder, that is anorexia nervosa. Mm-hmm. I've struggled with it for 14 or 15 years. I'm driving along on my way to work and I'm in a terrible car accident, no fault of mine, and I've got a number of orthopedic issues. Mm. I come into hospital and instead of people focusing on the fact that I've got broken bones, everyone's like, oh, she's painfully thin. Mm. She's, you know, got a long history of anorexia. We need to make sure that she eats the entire time that she's there. Mm. You're saying like meal times are going to be the most stressful part, probably not the surgery to do with my bones, it's the meals.
Yeah.
So having a nurse come down and say, okay, you know, what the orthopedic surgeons are saying is you've got to get some nutrition to heal your bones, to heal these wounds. What is the most distressing part of mealtime for you? And if I say, look, breakfast is worse, and once I sort of have a little bit, I can start. But if I do say, actually everything, everything is really distressing, what you're suggesting is that rather than get into a, you're going to eat, you know, like I'm going to be watching you every step, you're saying, okay, what do you normally do for your distress? And so if I say, look, I do regularly have some, you know, benzodiazepine to help, or I play music, or I try to just put little bits on my plate at a time, then that's where the first intervention can come in.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So they aren't the eating disorder. They have an eating disorder. So I think separating the two is really, really important. So yeah, especially sensory strategies are amazing. So a lot of those grounding techniques that they can do to busy their hands, which ultimately helps busy the mind. Again, it's going to be different for everyone. But pre-planning that, getting the sensory things that they may need, maybe ice packs are really good at grounding them. That might be one strategy that they use.
So what, you hold some ice while you're eating so that the focus is on the ice?
Yeah, so even like having like an ice pack, just having that, and that sensation of, oh, this is quite cold right now, it kind of helps trip the loop that's on. That's
like, don't eat this, I'm going to get fat, don't eat this, I'm going to fat. Instead, I'm like, oh my goodness, my legs are so cold.
Yeah, it's like a circuit breaker kind of thing.
Right.
So it kind of helps with that as well. So, and then you're kind of helping yourself and them deal with that really distressing time with the meal. So obviously the meal's going to be distressing. So the language that we use, which we're going to be getting into later, and the conversations that happen are all part of help managing that distress as well.
I think this has really led us beautifully to your number two point, is what can we do to support the person who has an eating disorder? You've already been listing some of those things, but I guess it's really important for us to remember that if someone is in for some other condition, like orthopedics, post a car accident, who's been living with an eating disorder for 14 years, you know, it's important that we're not a group of narcissists of like, oh, we're going to get this person to put on some weight.
Well,
you know, we need to focus on our task at hand, don't we?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And it's going to be very distressing either way, being in hospital. So being that, approaching it with compassion and empathy for them, and acknowledging that this is so difficult, and this is probably going to be quite, you trying to minimize the trauma that's going to happen in hospital. Is really important.
It's also being realistic that really very few patients put on weight while they're in hospital. The people that put on weight in hospital are usually the shift workers.
Yeah, that's right. If our normal patients are, you know, patients who don't have an eating disorder aren't putting on weight, we can't expect our patients who have an eating disorder to come in and put on weight, can we?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you're removing the food that they are saying is a safe food. You're now taking away that and bringing in hospital food, which
not always delicious.
Isn't the best. Yeah. Some of it's nice, but some of it is, you would kind of be questioning it yourself, but it's important. The nutrition is their medicine. So.
And would you say, you know, if I met someone under these circumstances and they've been living with an eating disorder for 14 years and getting themselves to work every day and having a career and, you know, been a student or is a parent or whatever, this person's already incredibly resilient and must have a whole list of resources that if I take the time to connect with this person, they're going to be able to help give me the cues to help them to eat, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Everyone's individualistic. So we do apply the QEDS guidelines when appropriate to the criteria that they're meeting. But at the end of the day, this person has their own life and their own journey and what has led them to this moment and what they've used to cope. So whether that is restricting or it is purging, it's a coping strategy. And it's what they use to deal with that anxiety in that moment. So getting to know what is part of that and what does that look like and how we can best support them and in an environment that is going to be really sort of out of control for them and can be very overwhelming. And I think if someone especially has come in from a car crash and, you know, they've noticed that they're quite malnourished and they're needing that refeeding pathway, especially to help their body heal, it's it's going to be, it's, you know, they've got these injuries, they've got that, you know, the eating disorder part as well, which, you know, they may not even have addressed before. Again, this is all very individual for each patient, but coming at it, especially as like, if you're in a medical ward, we're feeding you, we're not curing your eating disorder. No. We're nourishing your body in order to be able to heal. And coming at it from, you know, if you're having this meal, oh, you'll be better once you have this meal, or you will, you know, you need this to get better. That is a part of the puzzle, but it's not helping with the core issue here. Yeah. So we are just one very small part of that journey there, and recognizing that we're not curing anything. We are assisting them in this moment to have the nourishment to heal and engage in those recovery services.
So I might put you on the spot here, but just say my eating disorder is bulimia and purging is a big part of that. You know, I eat and I vomit and I've been brought into the hospital. Everybody's bringing me all sorts of treats. You know, my family's coming up. Maybe this is something that I've kept hidden for a long time. I'm the bedside nurse and I notice that as soon as this patient eats, not long after they go to the toilet, I hear some vomiting.
Yeah.
Is it, how does the bedside nurse broach that subject then with the patient?
Look, that's a difficult one. I think especially like, what rapport have you built with that person? Are you someone who's met them 2 minutes ago and you've just seen them going to the toilet and vomiting whatever chocolates that they've just eaten from their family and friends? I think coming at it, so you're not just a stranger. So I think if you're going to be approaching them and saying, hey, I've just noticed that you're feeling a bit sick at the moment, and they start to become a bit guarded and defensive about it. Coming at it from a compassion point of view of going, is there something that, you know, is concerning you? Yeah. Is the fact that you are
something
feeling,
we need to be aware of?
Is this something that is going to be in, you know, quite impactful, because they're using that to deal with whatever's going on in their, with their thoughts, with their environment. That's what they're trying to use to cope right now. I think talking to the treating team about it, using the supports, and that's why the multidisciplinary team is really important. So looking at their, you know, physical observations, looking at their bloods, is seen as, is something else going on here, and then reaching out to the CL psychiatry service, I think is going to be really vital, because they've got that training and assessment to say, is this something that has recently developed? Is this something that is going to be impacting their everyday life? And would we approach this with a treatment perspective, or would we be alerting their GP or linking them in with some services? So not just sort of dismissing it, but you, coming at it from, is there something that you want to talk about? Is there something else going on here?
Yeah.
Even just opening up that conversation, I think can be really, you know, they may tell you to go away. I may tell you go away. And that's okay. But yeah. I think using that multidisciplinary team is going to be really vital for that conversation.
Yeah. I love your number three. It's going to rate as one of my all-time points, that we've got to be firm with the eating disorder, but compassionate with the person in front of us, our patient.
Yeah. I think as nurses, we get into this career because we're very caring people, and we want to, when we see someone who's distressed, we see a problem, we want to fix it and we want to console, and we're very caring in nature. And so it kind of goes against what our initial reaction is going to be when someone's really distressed and they're saying they can't do this. They can't have this meal. They can't have this snack. They can't keep this tube in. They can't keep having, and you're seeing that distress and you want to fix it and you want to make them feel better. So I can understand the fear and the feeling of being unsure and feelings that you're being almost cruel to the person by continuing with the guidelines and continuing with the pathway and adhering to those standards and the guidelines. I can totally empathize with that. And it does take practice and it does take time, but at the end of the day, you're not providing a service to them that's in their best interests if you are adhering to what the eating disorder wants. So if you're adhering to what the eating disorder wants, that you're prolonging their stay, you're prolonging the medical instability, and the level of control that the eating disorder is trying to gain in that moment is just increasing, and it's increasing their distress, especially if they've seen that, you know, they've pulled out the tube, they've had it out for 10 minutes and you haven't played any catch-up feeds and they're fully aware of the processes that go on, that are around that. So if you're wanting to appease the eating disorder in that moment, it's not good for that person in the long run. You're keeping them in hospital for longer. You've got that extended iatrogenic harm that can come of that as well. So it seems awful and mean in the moment and I get it, but at the end of the day, you are providing care to that person and you are not adhering to the eating disorder's requests.
I've picked up that you're frequently, I guess, personifying the eating disorder as separate. It's obviously a really useful strategy for us as healthcare providers to separate that from the person.
Yeah.
Is it something that's included in the therapeutic approaches at times as well? I'm totally ignorant to this. Is that one of the, I guess, strategies that is sometimes used? Yeah. So may a patient actually kind of separate and partition that? Is that a strategy that's used?
Yeah. Some patients who have had treatment before may already come into separating the eating disorder from themselves and talking about it as though it's another person being entity within itself. So they already have those strategies. So kind of respecting that as well. But even like with a first presentation, I'll say, so is the eating disorder quite loud right now? So separating that voice from their own and, you know, you are not the eating disorder. You aren't an eating disorder. You're a person who has an illness. And I think that separation, it helps them almost. I mean, my experience has helped them be able to sort of rationalize why they're having these thoughts. Why can't I just eat right now? Why can't I have the supplement that is in a popper? Why can't I do that? And it's that unknown and the frustration of it all. And it's saying, well, this is an illness. This isn't you that's choosing to do this. This is the illness that's there. You're treating that, but you're also letting that person have their own identity.
Yeah, and not feel shame. Maybe feel some guilt and remorse about the fact that they've purged following your example, but not actually attribute that to them being a bad person.
Yeah, exactly.
Number four is the importance of us using recovery-focused language when we're working with people who have an eating disorder. Can you talk us through that? And I guess I also want to point out that you're an expert in this area. It's very skilled. You know, this will, again, take some time for a bedside nurse or an allied health person or the cleaners or whatever to get their heads around using this language all the time. Yeah. But what is recovery-focused language?
So recovery-focused language is very much avoidance of the blaming and I guess putting that person into a label or an identity of what they have. So saying, you know, the ED purged on the floor, or they were very behavioral today. They were trying to tamper with the feed. So it's not, it isn't very therapeutic and it doesn't create a safe space for that person if you're talking about the patient in that way. And it doesn't help us that they don't feel as though they're in a caring environment if that language is being used. So I understand in medical wards, you've got bedside handovers and that can be really tricky, especially when trying to give a thorough handover. You know, you want to talk about what's happened in the day, what worked, what didn't work. And I think it's very important, especially when you're handing over, that you're avoiding using that language of they were difficult, they refused to have the supplement, they were pulling out their tube, they're doing this for attention seeking, and you're preemptively preparing that nurse to walk into a situation where they're already irritated, they're already feeling defeated, they're already feeling as though that they've already got that countertransference going on. When you're writing down progress notes, choosing the language that you're going to be using is really important because you're setting a tone for everyone that's going to be reading it as well. So using language that is recognized of what an eating disorder is. So the eating disorder was quite, you know, she was became very distressed today. You know, the eating disorder was quite in control in this moment. So, you know, we tried to use PRNs, we tried to use distraction techniques. It didn't work. We've talked about how we can approach the next meal and what strategies we can use. She says she's going to try afternoon tea. And using language that's working with them and not talking about them as though it's something that is that is almost like your own supervision, I think is really important to avoid that. And knowing that the bed space is not a soundproof area. So if you're talking about them even outside the bed space, they can still hear you. They're still aware of what's going on. We've had a lot of patients come over from medical and say, you know, I could hear the nurses talking about me all day and how difficult I was. It wasn't meaning to be. I was really overwhelmed. I was really anxious and I didn't know what to do in that moment. And and they're alone and they're vulnerable and they're in a very vulnerable area. So I think it's as much as, you know, we need to check in with ourselves of how we are approaching patients and what am I feeling in this moment is why am I feeling irritated right now? Why am I feeling agitated? I get that it's busy, but coming at it as though, you know, this is what I want to say in this moment. This is what I want to do. It may feel okay in that moment, but in the long run, it's not helping anything. It's not helping anyone and especially not helping that person or your coworkers.
It's just hit me then thinking about, for the majority of nurses, medical, surgical nurses, pain seems to be a good analogy here. So follow me down the rabbit hole. So in terms of a psychosensory phenomenon that's affecting the patient but isn't part of who they are or a conscious decision they're making to have pain and be regulated in their behaviours, affect by pain, we can actually, I think that provides a really good, hopefully, a reasonable working model for thinking about, say, an eating disorder where there's going to be mixed components of sensory input, but also thinking about the ladder of interventions that we would use with that, of starting with simple and then moving up that ladder of interventions, multimodal interventions, like picking up on what you said about the sensory stuff that actually is more than just distraction therapy. It's actually got a neurological component to it in the disinhibition of cognition because of the high sensory input for your brain. So your brain will selectively channel the sensory information over the cognitive information. So there's a lot of parallels to pain, which I think can hopefully, if you're getting in that point, bloody hell, this is frustrating. You can go, actually, what would I be doing if this was pain rather than eating?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So if, you know, if that model especially helps with your approach, that's for sure going to be helpful. But I think, and then also coming back to, this person has a starved brain, conflict decision-making is not in their wheelhouse right now. They are having the emotional instability that's there. I mean, I think we've all been hangry at some point of our shifts, in some point of our lives. The irritation and the emotional dysregulation that occurs, that can occur from that, is quite acute. So if you're having, you know, someone in an environment that is going against their normal thinking and then their normal coping strategies, they're going to have some emotional dysregulation. Their brain is being refed so they can engage and they can use coping strategies and they can, ground themselves so they can have that next meal or snack. So I think, I understand it, you know, the wards can be really demanding, frustrating. And I think what's helped me is reminding myself of like that core psychopathology, what's going on for this person right now. They don't have the capacity to regulate at this stage. So how can we help in this moment? And you may not get it right every time, but I think trying is really important.
And so finally, you're bringing us home with your number five, which is consistency is the key. And I guess the thing that I'm curious to hear you talk about is it's not just consistency with the, you know, with you and the person who has the eating disorder, but I see this across the board in all sorts of things. It's nurse to nurse. So you can't have one nurse who comes in and is so compassionate. It's like, I can see you really trying. Like, is there something in particular that would tempt you? If calories are important at the moment. And then someone come in and go, this is the hospital. Yeah. Like, you will eat it. I will stand over you with this light in your face. But, you know, just in between each other, some consistency. Because if we know that when it comes to someone having an eating disorder, being out of control, being anxious, being afraid are all triggers for making the eating disorder more escalated or prevalent for someone, then not having consistency in an approach is only going to harm and escalate the whole continuum, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. So if you're having that conversation prior to the shift, I think it's going to be more predictable for that patient. Whereas if you've got, you know, one shift where you've got the nurse saying, oh, you know, okay, you know, you're really distressed, you don't want to finish the dessert, that's fine. or the jelly or the yogurt or something like that, we'll just, it's fine. You're then setting up the next nurse to then say, well, I am adhering to this, to the meal plan, and you have to eat this. And it's inevitably creating that split in the staff where some staff are like, oh, I don't care, whatever. And you got some staff that are like, well, no, they need, you know, you wouldn't give someone half an antibiotic. You'd give someone a whole antibiotic. That's doesn't make any sense for their treatment not to have that whole medication, just like the nutrition is their medication. So treating it as though it's not just food, it's this person is getting that nourishment and the medication that they need, and having that approach and just, you know, to having those conversations with staff and saying, you know, we get, you know, some staff might be burnt out. Maybe someone else can take over today and, you know, uphold and be able to be there emotionally for that patient, because that predictability in that environment is very, very important, because you've got an eating disorder that's trying to take control of every single aspect of what's going in and what's going out. And if there is that room there, they're going to, you know, that eating disorder is going to try to look for control in other areas. Whereas if it's got that predictability and that standard of, no, we have to do, this is the choice you have right now. You know, you've got, you can finish the meal, you can have the supplement, or if it's too hard, we can't do this NG if you need. And if that's consistent, it sounds like it's sort of counterintuitive because they are becoming distressed, but it's that standard. It's the, you know, this environment is out of control, but what we're going to be able to control right now is we're adhering to the guidelines. And again, I can understand with medical nursing and you want to try to appease the person in that moment, but you're not doing any good for them in the long run. It's just, you know, harming them more in the short term.
And it's been consistent with trauma-informed care principles.
Exactly,
as well.
Yeah.
You're providing choice.
Yeah.
You're providing three choices,
yeah,
in your example that you gave,
yeah,
which is really important.
Yeah.
But one of those choices isn't one that's actually allowing, yeah, continued harm.
Yes,
to the person.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think also just a strategy that I've used, I know this might be a little bit off topic, but just a strategy that I've found, especially in those heightened states of distress when it comes to if they're saying, you know, I just can't finish it, I can't do it, I can't supplement, I can't have any of this, is saying, look, I understand this must be so hard for you at the moment, but these are the options that we have and you can control the outcome of what's going to happen right now. So we can either finish the meal that we have right now, you can finish the supplement if that seems easier, or if it's too much for choice, we can make the choice for you and do the NG feed. So giving them, even though in a very uncontrollable environment, giving
some
them
power,
that availability of control. So
yeah,
giving them those choices is actually very empowering, and it can be, and it can also be quite grounding because you're trying to focus their mind. They're thinking of a million different things at this moment, trying to bring them back to the conversation, holding them in that moment of which area are we going to be going into today? And this is, you know, this is up to you and this is how it's going to be for the day.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. So let's try and summarize all this complexity with the patient who is with us, who has an eating disorder. So your number one is, first of all, let's understand what an eating disorder is and then recognize that for this person, mealtime is going to be extremely distressing. So I guess in summarizing eating disorders, it's that someone really is over-evaluating their weight, their shape, and they have a persistent fear of gaining weight. And all of that can, for some people, dominate their entire lives. And no, that's not logical, but that is part of what having an eating disorder is. There's a disconnection from what the body needs physically for nutrition and what the eating disorder requires. And that for anyone who has had an eating disorder or is continuing to fight with an eating disorder, meal times are a nightmare. That's what I've heard loud and clear. And that instead of allowing that to just become an issue each time, what would be really helpful is having a plan. So having a plan, giving some choice, you know, you've been living with this for a long time. Let's tell, and if you need some PRN, we're going to give it to you and we're going to give you it to you far enough in advance in the meal that hopefully it helps. Your number two is, what can health professionals do to support a patient with an eating disorder? And I heard here it's relationship, relationship, relationship. Being respectful that this person has potentially been living with an eating disorder for a long time. What helps? What doesn't help? Knowing that if someone says nothing helps, then we still have to come back and say, this is the protocol. This is what we're going to do. These are the areas of choice. But there's this huge complexity around this illness, and that's what it is. It absolutely is an illness. And what we want to do is reduce shame, because we don't want people hiding and doing things behind our back. We want to at least keep the dialogue as open as possible. And the only way we're going to do that is if we take the time to build the relationship. Number three is be firm with the eating disorder. Be compassionate with the person who has the eating disorder. And sometimes these people, because the eating disorder is very strong within them, is so distressed by the fact that we're requesting, well, not even requesting, we're telling them that they have to eat, that it can feel very cruel. And I think you use the word torturous, like it can feel as the nurse, bedside nurse, that you're torturing this person. What we've got to remember is that if someone was saying to us, I can't have this antibiotic, I can't have this antibiotic, we would have to find a way to give the antibiotic. And for this person, food is the medication. It's part of the treatment plan. And so we always want to be able to separate the person from this illness. So we wouldn't say to someone who's lost all their hair from a cancer treatment, you've deliberately lost your hair. You know, we're recognizing that that's cancer. And I guess part of this compassion is seeing that this eating disorder has a hold of this person so strongly, just like any other disease that can do, and it is life-threatening. Number four, use recovery-focused language at all times. And that is not just oral, and it's not just with the patient. It's how we hand over. It's the notes that we write in the chart.
Yeah.
And so using blaming language, labeling language, you know, the anorexic in bed 17 has been difficult all day and pulled out their tube.
I've heard that one before.
You know, if I'm hearing that, none of that is going to assist this person to use food as a form of medication. So instead of calling something attention seeking, you know, we might say this, they're really struggling. They've been quite dysregulated today. And I actually really liked that you talked about, you know, we've all been hangry.
Yeah.
And anyone who's been hangry, you're short, you're distracted, you're dysregulated because all you can think about, these people are chronically hangry.
Yeah.
And that must be a terrible thing when your stomach is saying, eat, eat, eat. But everything in this eating disorder is saying, don't do it or you will fail. You'll be fat. You'll be hopeless. You'll be whatever. And so anytime we're engaging, again, going back to point three, being compassionate, but using a language like, you know, how can we best support you? Mm. What does this look like for you? Mm. Can you give us a tip? Yeah. I think is important.
Yeah.
And that leads us last but not least into the fact that consistency is the key. And that's consistency in the way that we engage with the person with the eating disorder. It's the way that we as a team approach this. Yeah. So I can't, you know, you're just because the patient is a similar age to me, I can't be like, yeah, don't worry about the jelly. Don't worry about that. If you can just eat a little bit of that, that's going to be fine. You're setting things up much harder for the person behind you who's going to nurse. But worse than that, you're depriving that patient of an important medication, which is nutrition, to get better. And so what I loved is this offering of choice. So no, you don't have a choice about how many calories you're having today, but the choice is you can eat that. You can eat that and you can have some of that as a supplement. Or if you really can't do any of that, you can have a nasogastric tube and we can give it to you that way.
Yeah.
Like they're the choices. It's not the choice around the calorie. Yeah. And I think the consistency with the compassion and the consistency with the message actually does help provide a great deal of safety for that person because there's some boundaries around it.
That's right. Yep. That's a very good summary. Yeah.
Yay. Rondi, thank you so much for coming and talking to us. I know that this is something when we were in the wards, a lot of junior staff really struggled with. So I hope this is really beneficial to them. So thanks for sharing your expertise with us today on Five Things.
Thank you for having me.
The Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital Five Things Nursing Podcast acknowledges the Turrbal and Yuggera as the First Nations owners of the lands we now tread. We pay respect to their elders, laws, customs and creation spirits. We recognise that these lands have always been places of healing, teaching and learning. We also wish to acknowledge the First Nations people of the lands of our global community and encourage our listeners to seek out, listen and learn from the knowledge held in your shared space. As well as all major podcast outlets, you can find us at 5thingsnursing.podbean.com. Please also subscribe and give us a rating on your listening platform of choice. This helps others find the podcast. And finally, if you'd like to connect with Liz or myself on Twitter, we can be found at LizCrow2. And for me, it's inject_orange. We would absolutely love to hear your thoughts, ideas, or feedback. Thanks for listening to 5 Things,